Welcome to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard weekly at this time on 1450 AM and 107.1 FM. Today's guest is Dr. Francis Ferdinand, thoracic and cardiac surgeon at UPMC Hammond. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us today. Can you share with us a little bit about your background?
So I did my cardiothoracic training at the University of Chicago, and then I had a unique opportunity. I was able to go to the UK and worked with a quite famous cardiac surgeon there, Sir Magdi Yacoub, and at the Royal Brompton Hospitals, the National Heart and Lung Institute, and I was in the academic department of cardiothoracic surgery. And after that, I got a great opportunity there. I was actually a visiting fellow in Paris with another very famous skilled surgeon, Alain Carpentier, who's very famous for mitral valve repair. And then I came back to the USA and took a position at the Cleveland Clinic for a year, and then I was in Philadelphia for about 14 years. And from there, I went to upstate New York and took a position up there, and then they recruited me here. And I've been here about a year and 18 months, a year and a half.
February is American Heart Month. Do you believe that this month helps create awareness and prevention of heart disease?
I do, and I think it's very important. You know, cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer in the United States. And the exciting but yet slightly depressing aspect of that is that for several years now, the death rate from cardiovascular disease, and that's heart attack, stroke, has been decreasing rapidly. Really, I don't think it gets enough credit. I mean, the healthcare in the United States is the best in the world. And you can look at that by the essentially the end result. Deaths from cardiovascular disease, number one, killer, number two is cancer, have plummeted over the past decade. That's results. And but one of the slightly depressing aspects of that is it was believed in the next year or two the death rate from cardiovascular disease was actually going to – it was going down so rapidly it was going to actually go below the death rate for cancer, which was also going down. So that cardiovascular disease would be the number two killer. Regretfully, over the past year or two, it started to level off. So they're almost in parallel now, but cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer, and so it's still incredibly important that we raise awareness of cardiovascular disease.
Doctor, can you tell us about the Heart and Vascular Institute and why some believe this is now one of the world's premier centers for comprehensive cardiovascular care?
Yeah, so the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center created a Heart and Vascular Institute. And what that does is it brings people together who share an interest in caring for folks with cardiovascular disease and brings them under one structure. You know, a traditional structure within, say, the university and the medical school is you would have a department of surgery, for example, and the department of surgery has a division of vascular surgeons. So vascular surgeons are in that department. I'm a visiting professor of surgery in the Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery, so that's another department. The cardiologists are a division of cardiology in the Department of Medicine, that's another. So, but what the Heart and Vascular Institute does, it brings together the cardiologists, the cardiothoracic surgeons, and the vascular surgeons into a organized structure where people can collaborate more and provide, you know, better care to patients, because patients don't understand or don't need to have all the what may be academic divisions or separations. They want to, you know, if they have cardiovascular disease, they want to be cared for, and it's very more efficient to provide higher quality care if all of us collaborate together and provide all the care to the patient about that problem. So that's the kind of physicians in it, cardiac surgeons, cardiologists, vascular surgeons are all in the Heart and Vascular Institute. Now, every site that provides those services in UPMC has a local Heart and Vascular Institute. And Hammond is one of the largest because we do the whole Northwest Pennsylvania in addition to New York as well as parts of Ohio. So we have a huge area that we provide care to, everything from the city of Erie to a lot of rural hospitals out in the region. So we provide – this allows us to maximize the strengths of that collaborative environment of the Heart and Vascular Institute and provide it locally to the patients where they are and where they live.
Doctor, we have discussed the fact with other specialists that some believe that the quality of care in a bigger city must be better than Erie. Are there any thoughts that a new patient would like to know about the quality of care they will receive at the Heart and Vascular Institute right here in Erie?
Correct, yes. Well, that's actually a major emphasis. And one of the interests that I had in coming here was the UPMC thought processes of exactly that topic. And the point of having this Heart and Vascular Institute was that it should provide the same care no matter where you are. So there's very few services that we don't do here. For example, if you needed a heart transplant or a complicated left ventricular assist device to support your heart, that's something we would send to Pittsburgh. Because they have, and we're fully integrated with that, with transportation, with physician communication, all of that's completely integrated. Aside from that, there's not much else that you would need to travel for. So we have, and that's why they recruited folks like myself and my other colleagues here, is to provide the same level of care here that you could provide down there. And then the UPMC Hammett provides the infrastructure to allow us to do that. As you know, there's a new building going up. I think there's $129 million for this new patient care tower, which will have our imaging for cardiology and cardiovascular surgery, ICU beds. So the investment in this site at Hammett has been profound by UPMC and by locally, by the community, as well as our board, the Hammett Health Foundation, so that we have the infrastructure to provide the top-level care to the patients right here. But we also have that integrated approach where we are constantly interacting with the center in Pittsburgh as well. So I have a full faculty appointment in the medical school. We go there for teaching. Folks from there for specialized areas, some of the cardiologists who do, for example, amyloid, come up here. We started in the cardiology division, an MRI, cardiac MRI imaging. So they have complete collaboration and integration with the MRI in Pittsburgh. So if you get a cardiac MRI here, it's identical as if you had a cardiac MRI in Pittsburgh. And if you had surgery or, you know, cardiology treatment here, it would be the same as in Pittsburgh, except for very areas where the numbers wouldn't make sense to do it here. You know, for example, a heart transplant. There wouldn't be enough heart transplants for us to do here. It makes no sense. But as a system, we can provide strength by referring those type things to Pittsburgh, and so they can become a center of excellence. Plus, as you probably realize, Pittsburgh was one of the centers in the world of transplant. So it would be silly to try and replicate that here when we have a world-renowned and world-class center in Pittsburgh that we actively collaborate with.
The HVI recently reached a transcatheter aortic valve replacement milestone. I believe it was around 700. Can you explain what TAVR is and what type of patients it benefits?
That's a great question. So TAVR is transaortic valve replacement. Now, you'll also see some people call TAVI, TAVI, transaortic valve implantation. But basically, this technology extends from work that was done back in the 70s and 80s. A French cardiologist thought if someone had aortic stenosis, so your aortic, all the blood in your body passes through your heart, but that doesn't do your heart any good. That's work for your heart. Then right after all, the left ventricle comes to the left side, right? The right side, all the blood gets back by breathing and moving our legs and arms. You basically squeeze all the blood to the center of your body, and then by breathing, all the blood comes into your chest. And then it goes to the right side of your heart. And the right side's got the easy job. All it has to do is pump the blood across your lungs. And your heart and lungs are both up in your chest. The lungs have very low resistance. So the right side's got the easy job. It just pumps the blood across the lungs. It comes back to the left side of your heart. It goes through the left atrium, through a mitral valve, goes to the left ventricle, the pumping chamber. And then the left ventricle, when it squeezes, pumps the blood out through the aortic valve. And the reason blood moves in one direction in these two parallel circuits is because when the heart squeezes, the mitral valve closes, and the aortic valve opens, so the blood goes out. And then when the heart relaxes, the aortic valve closes, the mitral valve opens, and the heart fills. But the leaflets of the aortic valve are almost translucent. They're so thin, and amazingly, they could last your whole life. But in some folks, it doesn't, and it starts getting thicker and sclerotic and doesn't open as much. So, for example, if I told you to blow out, you went, You say, oh, that was easy. I said, now here's a straw, or here's a little cocktail straw. Now try blowing out. You're like, wow, that's a lot of work. Well, that's kind of what the heart experiences with aortic stenosis. So medicines can help with symptoms. Sometimes people, because the heart's working so hard, fluid builds up. So you can give them a medicine to help them get rid of fluid, a diuretic. But that's just the symptoms. But this is a structural problem. The valve just isn't opening or enough. And so traditionally, we would open the patient's chest up, put them on a heart-lung machine so that we could stop the heart and work on it inside the heart, and then remove the old valve and put a new valve in. And this has been being done for decades, and that works quite well. However, what they noticed was older patients, it's harder for them to recover from a big surgery, and some of the times that was prohibitive. And so back in the 70s, this French cardiologist, Cribier, would put a balloon across the aortic valve and dilate it. And that worked in some patients. It allowed the valve to open a little bit for a short period of time, maybe 6 months or so, helped them improve their symptoms, but it would reoccur again because you haven't taken care of the primary problem. So fast forward a couple decades, and a Danish cardiologist by the last name Anderson thought of, why don't we put a tissue valve on a stent, like a large coronary stent, but only obviously much bigger. Instead of a couple of millimeters, it's a couple of centimeters. And so they did that, and that was the first TAVR valves that were done, so that you would thread a catheter through the arteries in the body and then across the aortic valve and then expand this valve on a metal stent within the patient's own aortic valve and then have that new tissue valve working. And that has been the product of multiple studies. For one company, Edwards was the partner 1, 2, and 3. They started out in Europe and the U.S. with very high-risk patients. So patients who were too sick for surgery, they said, no, they'll never survive surgery. Or they were very, very high risk. And so the government insisted that they do a large clinical trial randomizing patients to medical therapy or this procedure. And that study showed that it was much better than medical therapy alone. And then they moved it with the second round of trials to intermediate risk patients. And they just released, which got a lot of press, the 1 trials, which were low risk patients, which didn't say a whole lot. It basically says you could do it in low risk patients. But we kind of knew that if you can do it in patients who are too sick, you could certainly do it in healthy patients. The big question for the valves going forward is, how long will they last? Surgical valves, we have a very good idea how long they'll last because we've been using them for decades, and there's newer iterations of them. But the TAVR valve was initially used. It's only been approved in the United States since 2011, 2012. It was put in folks who were too sick, and they might not have only lived a year or two. So how long will they last? 5 years? Will they last 10 years? Especially if they're younger and healthier and theoretically putting more wear and tear on the valve, how long do they last in those patients? And that's an ongoing trial. So we don't know that. But we started almost immediately in 2012 here at Hammett a program. It's a comprehensive program, and everyone works together as what we call a heart team. So the surgeons and cardiologists work together. And as a matter of fact, CMS, the government, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, insisted when it gave a national coverage decision that this must be done together. And that's a whole backstory I can give you if you wanted it. But the surgeon and the cardiologist see the patients before the procedure, during the workup. We do the procedure together as co-surgeons. So the surgeon and cardiologist are together in the hybrid room. We have a hybrid room in a cath lab where we could do surgery, or do a cardiac intervention, and then post-operatively, and then in follow-up. So it's an incredible technology. It can really help a lot of patients who are very sick and would be high risk otherwise, and we've got great results with it.
What are some of the other procedures you see today that weren't as frequent 10 years ago?
I think the way we do bypass surgery, still the most common cardiac procedure we do, cardiac surgery, is to use blood vessels to bypass blockages in the heart arteries. And so like I said earlier, even though the heart pumps all the blood through it, that's just work for the heart. The heart muscle has its own set of arteries, and those are the coronary arteries. And so those have become cardiac bypass surgery from a surgical point of view, you kind of dipped down several years ago because people were using a lot of stents, but a lot of trials have shown that we have to be judicious about using coronary stents by the cardiology because in some cases it may not be any better than just good medical therapy. And so we're seeing more bypass surgery done, and here we like to do them, use we tend to use artery from the chest wall, the mammary artery, which can last 30, 35 years. That's the most effective bypass or revascularization graft you can use in existence, really. And we also use veins from the leg or an artery from the forearm. So we try to use more arteries in younger patients. So we're doing much more of that than 10 years ago. We're doing more bypass surgery in general than 10 years ago. And here we're also doing a lot of what I do is off-pump surgery. So normally we would put the patient on a heart-lung machine to stop the heart while you're working on it. But other techniques we found that, you know, the arteries that we bypass or the cardiologist would stent are on the surface of the heart. So if you can stabilize the surface of the heart can still beat, and then you can do the bypass. You can avoid any side effects of the bypass machine. So that's being done more today than it was. The types of valves we're using in addition to the TAVR we're doing more of. The our electrophysiology colleagues, they're cardiologists who specialize in heart rhythm changes, more defibrillators, patients who are at risk of arrhythmias, which can cause a heart attack in the field. So these are internal defibrillators. You know, you see on TV where someone has a heart rhythm and they put the paddles on them. Well, this is an internal device. It's just a little bit bigger than a pacemaker. And for folks whose heart function is poor and who have a lot of symptoms of heart failure, they do what we call a biventricular pacing, where studies have shown that those patients who meet certain criteria, especially how long their EKG complex is, that typically a pacemaker goes on the right side, right atrium, right ventricle, because the venous side is low pressure. But the left ventricle, if you just pace the right side, that has its own effects long term. Mm-hmm. And they found that patients with heart failure, enlarged hearts, that EKG thing, that if they can pace both ventricles, the left and the right, that they actually perform better. And the question was, well, how do you get a lead on the left side? You don't want to put one through an artery in a high pressure. So if you get into the venous system of the heart, you can thread one over on that side. Sometimes that can be challenging, and so surgically we'll make a tiny little incision and we can put it on the left side of the heart, on the surface of the heart, and then connect it to their system so that their right and left ventricles are being paced. So that's also new. This being not new, brand new, but it's being done more than it was, say, 10 years ago.
Doctor, can you explain the technological advantages that heart patients have locally by being a patient at UPMC Hammett's Heart and Vascular Institute that may not be available elsewhere?
Our TAVR program is certainly more robust than anywhere locally. Another thing that our pulmonary lung colleagues do is something called robotic bronchoscopy. So someone can have a mass in their lung that you see on a chest x-ray, you work it up, you get a CAT scan. Depending where that lump is, it could be challenging to get to it, to get a specimen from it, to say, is this just a scar or an old lymph node, or is this actually potentially a cancer that needs to be treated? And if we can find it early, and they're harder to find if you were to look at the lung, a small lesion, which is what we want to find them, if you can find that and diagnose that and start the treatment, you can have a profound effect on the patient's survival. And so one thing that's been pioneered here is what we call robotic bronchoscopy, where we can use that imaging and navigate through the patient's airways to right where that small little lesion is, and then know that we can biopsy in this one area, we're going to get at that even small lesion. And that's something that no one else has. And this site has been a leader in it, actually, nationally. And so that's an important technology we have here. The other things that we're doing are some of the other procedures we're doing that are being used elsewhere, but not to the degree, the numbers, and they don't have the same infrastructure and support that we have here.
Do all adult demographics need to be aware of our risk of heart disease? And can you share more about lifestyle changes that adults should employ to prevent heart disease?
Right. That's a great question, too. So everyone should be aware. And the good news is that it does not take a lot of we have a lot of fancy technology here. But to diagnose most things, you don't need all that. So we can find a lot of folks and help a lot of folks with basic physical exam and history. So for most people, if you just got your blood pressure checked and then got a couple of lab tests, blood draw, you could find out what their blood pressure is, and then you could check what their blood sugar is, and then you could see what their lipid levels, cholesterol levels are, and their kidney function. And you can do all that with a simple blood test and an exam. You don't need CAT scans or any of these other fancy tests we use once we get more into exactly what they have. So you can find a lot of that by very screening, like the American Heart Association has done at work, doing these biometric, fancy name for saying checking your blood pressure and your blood levels. That can be done very, very quickly and very easily, and it's very inexpensive. And you'll see a lot of fairs in town. Erie has a lot of events down on Perry Square here. So, and you'll see like a mobile health clinic, and they'll check people's blood pressure. You can do finger sticks, check your blood sugar. Those are all very simple things to screen people to say, now you should get that followed up. Now, as far as – so that's the diagnosis part of it. But then as far as the lifestyle, a lot of things that we can do are very simple. Like one is why we sponsor the Heart Walk. You know, getting people to exercise more. Today with computers and all that, we don't do as much physical labor or activity. You don't have to spend – I mean, you can join a gym. There's nothing wrong with that. That's wonderful. There's a lot of great ones in the area. But, you know, a pair of comfortable shoes, you can go for a walk. And you see some of our staff here, you know, the hallway between – you came in through the women's hospital. So if you go to the other hospital, there's like a long hallway down there. And you'll see some folks there. They're just on their lunch break. They just go for a walk back and forth. And I try to do that too. You know, I can do some notes on a computer over in the hospital, but sometimes if I have a little break, I'll walk over here to do it just to get, you know, a couple floors of steps in and just walking back and forth. So there's very simple things you do, walking. And even if you do have a job where you're in an office, you can get up, walk around for a few minutes, or instead of printing stuff in your office, print it down the hall so you walk, get up and walk around. So a lot of straightforward things like that. And then nutrition, there's so many misconceptions about nutrition. And there's so much nonsense on the internet that I will put a plug in for that. I mean, I know UPMC has a great website and has information. The American Heart Association really has done a wonderful job. If you go to their main website, there's a healthy living drop-down menu, and they have tremendously good information in there about nutrition, stress management, quitting smoking, exercise. And they're not trying to sell you anything. They I think the only thing they sell are cookbooks, and they accept donations like we accept donations. So there's no – but just like what your grandmother probably said is eat your fruits and vegetables. You know, we eat a lot of meat and things like that, which is good for you, but you don't need as much of it as we think we do. The human body is amazingly efficient. Like Elon Musk, you know, his electric car, you can't come close to what the human body is as efficiency. And we literally just don't need as many calories as we take in. But we have taste buds. We like the taste of it. So we eat more than we need to for our physical activity. So it's a matter, I think, in this country especially, because we're wealthy and we have a – you go to any supermarket, there's like tons of choices. I think that it's the proportion of the amount of food we eat. And then you can look at what we eat. So we don't – generally, I would say we don't need to eat as much. And then the types of foods we eat, you really just – what your grandmother said, lots of more fruits and vegetables and smaller amounts of the other things. You can still have a Big Mac, you can still have French fries, but you can't have that every day. So I think you just need to do it in proportion.
Doctor, can you discuss the impact that inherited genetic risk factors mean for those of us that have family members that suffered or died from heart disease?
Okay. So the inherited thing, that's important. And generally, when we ask it as part of the history and physical exam, what you're looking for is early cardiovascular disease. So if someone's father had a heart attack in their 40s and 50s, that's clinically relevant. I'm always careful when patients tell me that and we discuss that, because I don't want folks to get this fatalistic attitude that, well, you know, my uncle or my parents had heart disease, therefore I have it. Because in general, we adopt the habits of the family we grew up in, right? So if the parents smoke, there's a heck of a lot more likelihood that the children will smoke. Mm-hmm. Same thing with their activity levels and nutrition, and if they're overweight, the obesity, all those things tend to run in families because we adopt those habits growing up. And then once you have a habit, obviously, you know, it's hard to get rid of it. So those are very, very important. And so it's good to know that, gee, if dad or uncle or mom had this condition, maybe it's even more impetus, get checked early in your 20s. You know, I don't know if you ever saw that movie Saving Private Ryan, big World War II movie, but it was about that time when they would do autopsies on the soldiers who were killed, and they saw – now, these are 18, 19, 20-year-old healthy kids, most of them, despite movies. Most of them were young kids. And they would see these fatty streaks in their aorta. And they were, like, puzzled. Like, why would there be fatty streaks in a young, healthy kid, basically? And they realized that arteriosclerosis starts in your 20s and 30s. But then it builds up over decades. So when someone has a heart attack today, it didn't just start today. They've been building up plaque for decades. It just got to the point where it's now limiting blood flow. Or a plaque with cholesterol and fats in it ruptures, and that closes the – which is a very common end result. But that was been building up for decades. So if you can identify someone in their 20s and 30s that does have high blood pressure or high cholesterol levels, if you can treat them then, they may never get to the point down the road of developing heart disease or high blood pressure. So that's why it's so important. And I do want to go back to at the beginning. This will tie in with what we talked about with Heart Month and screening, is that screening folks, is that these folks, if you develop that early by preventative measures, you can have a big effect on where they develop the disease going forward. Now, one of the other things is smoking. One of the reasons that the death rate from cardiovascular disease was going down so rapidly was because of smoking, anti-smoking campaigns, and the percentage of folks who smoke has dropped down markedly from what it was a decade ago, 2 decades ago. So that's had a huge effect on the health benefits. And unfortunately, it's ticking up again. Women and teenagers are smoking more, and how they allowed vaping to get through, because you're basically giving them an addicting drug. And we know that especially teenagers who vape and get addicted to the nicotine, are then going to go on to smoke cigarettes. So that's been a big issue. So if you find someone in your 20s and 30s, hey, your family has a history, just get checked, simple test, and then get them also not smoking, you can have we've already seen the effect that can have. One of the reasons it's leveled off, though, is childhood obesity. And so that's really, we've done a wonderful job with smoking. Vaping is, you know, a problem, and we need to jump on that as well, but we know how to do that. But childhood obesity is one of the reasons that the death rate from cardiovascular disease is leveled off, because we've not seen children with as much obesity as we see now. And then, so if they start off with all these bad risk factors, which are mostly acquired, diabetes and high blood pressure, cholesterol levels, if they're having that in their teenage years to 20s, well, we're now seeing patients in their 40s with, you know, heart attacks and needing bypass surgery or coronary stents or things like that, whereas normally we might not see that to their 60s or 70s. So that's a very, very important, is the time. You know, sometimes we get focused on the short term. These simple things that you can do now can have a profound effect over the years and decades to your quality of life and your longevity, how long you'll live down the road. So it's very important to stress that, and especially in Heart Month, that these are very simple things you can do. Quick blood tests and exam, and you can find out almost all the risk factors, and not smoking, you can find all the risk factors of cardiovascular disease. And then if you make some modest changes in lifestyle, perhaps you need some medical therapy to control blood pressure, things like that, or blood sugar, with that, you can have a profound effect and lead a very healthy and active life.
Doctor, thanks so much for joining us. Last question here. If someone has a heart episode or is living with discomfort but has not sought medical care yet, what is your recommendation?
Let's go to your local primary doctor, who probably knows you better or knows your family. Let's say someone's in their 40s or 50s and has never really gone to the doctor, but their mom has a doctor. They know that person. That person knows their history. Go to your family doctor. And like I said, they'll do an exam. They can check an EKG. They can check your blood pressure. I mean, most important thing they'll do is get your history, find out if you're smoking, check your blood pressure, and check your blood levels for your sugar, your one creatinine, we call it, for your kidney function, and your lipid or cholesterol levels. And all just that information from that visit with your family doctor can tell you most, and mostly you can get treated by your family doctor. You don't need to see a surgeon, a cardiac surgeon, or a cardiologist. Most of that your family doctor will do. And if your family doctor has some questions or it needs a little bit more intense therapy, then they'll consult the cardiologist. And if they needed more, they'll consult us as well. But a lot of that can be done very close to your home, very convenient, and with someone who knows you and your family best.
Thanks for listening to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard Fridays at 12:30 p.m. and Saturdays at 9 a.m. Join us again next week as the Erie Regional Chamber and Growth Partnership is in the Business Spotlight.